This week on Our World, the high cost of obesity and what we can do about it, how carbon dioxide in the air is making the ocean more acidic, and setting a goal for the next step in human spaceflight.
We're much better prepared today to send humans to Mars than they were to be able to send men to the moon in 1961, and they were there 8 years later.
Those stories, a network of instruments that could provide life-saving earthquake warnings, and more. I'm Art Chimes. Welcome to VOA's Science and Technology magazine, Our World. Americans are known for a lot of things around the world, but love us or hate us, you probably think we weigh too much. And we do. Two-thirds of adults in the United States and one out of five children are above what doctors consider a healthy weight for their size, and those numbers have been increasing. And people who are above their healthy weight are, not surprisingly, not as healthy. It's no wonder experts talk about an epidemic of obesity.
Obesity and with it diabetes are the only major health problems that are getting worse in this country, and they're getting worse rapidly.
Dr. Thomas Frieden, head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, says the rate of obesity has doubled over the past generation. A new study published this week puts a dollar estimate on that epidemic of obesity, $140 billion a year in extra medical costs. Obese people spend, on average, $1,500 per year more for their medical care than a person of healthy weight. And of course, says Frieden, the financial burden is only part of the story.
Beyond the economic costs are the disability, the suffering, and the early deaths caused by obesity. And this is something that we as a society need to take more action to address.
We should explain our terms here. Obesity is defined based on a body mass index of 30 or higher. For example, if you weigh 100 kilos and your height is 180 centimeters, your BMI is 31, which is considered obese. A separate category, overweight, applies to people who are above what's considered a healthy BMI, but not so much that it's classified as obese. The new study on the costs of obesity is published online by the journal Health Affairs. Lead author Eric Finkelstein says those costs have nearly doubled over the past decade. About half of those costs are paid for by government programs like Medicare, which insures older Americans.
Their average expenditures are about $4,700 if they're normal weight, and if they're obese, that number rises to about $6,400.
Finkelstein is affiliated with RTI International, a North Carolina research institute. He says obese older Americans are more likely to have chronic disease requiring medication, which drives up their medical costs. He discussed his study in Washington this week at the CDC's first ever National Conference on Obesity Control and Prevention. A report published in a CDC publication outlines a variety of ways to head off the spiraling obesity epidemic. William Dietz, head of CDC's obesity unit, says there are a number of strategies to get the weight off or keep people from gaining weight in the first place.
Strategies to support choices of healthy foods and beverages. Strategies to encourage breastfeeding. Strategies to encourage physical activity or to limit sedentary behavior. Or strategies to create communities that support physical activity.
Some of the recommendations include smaller portion sizes in restaurants, discouraging beverages sweetened with sugar, increased physical activities in school, improved access to walking and mass transit. Eric Finkelstein, the researcher who quantified the financial costs, says we have to do something.
So many differentials are involved that the only thing we do know is that in the absence of action, it's unlikely that costs associated with obesity are going to decrease.
One approach could be taxing some unhealthy foods, which would raise prices and maybe encourage people to make healthier eating choices. CDC Director Thomas Frieden cites the success of higher taxes in reducing smoking by half among teenagers in New York.
In the case of soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages, evidence from a couple of sources, including industry sources, suggests that higher prices will strongly discourage people from consuming soda and sugar-sweetened beverages.
Still, it's likely to be an uphill battle, changing the habits of millions of people who'd rather watch TV while eating fattening food than exercise or reduce the fat and calories in their diet. If you want to eat healthier, stay tuned. Our website of the week can help. That's coming up later in the show, but first, One of the most tragic aspects of the AIDS epidemic is transmission of the disease from mother to child. In low-income countries, hundreds of thousands of babies have had the virus passed on to them by their mothers, either during birth or while they're breastfeeding. But some new research should bring some hope to mothers with HIV. Rose Hoban reports.
Doctors have known for a decade that giving the antiretroviral drug AZT to HIV-positive women during labor greatly reduces the chance they will pass their disease on to their babies. But health authorities in Africa estimate that hundreds of thousands of children still contract HIV after birth, says Charles Vanderhorst, an AIDS researcher from the University of North Carolina.
We know that there are 420,000 babies infected each year with HIV. So, and it's devastating. Pediatric HIV is a medical emergency. Half these babies will be dead within a year.
Vanderhorst says standard infant formula isn't a good option for treating these babies, either because of cost, unavailability, or the risk of a bout of diarrhea, which can be fatal. So Vanderhorst and colleagues studied the effect of antiretroviral drugs on breastfeeding women and babies in the African nation of Malawi. In one arm of the study, they gave women a widely used regimen of three antiretroviral drugs for 28 weeks of breastfeeding after birth. Another group of women got an infant formulation of the antiretroviral nevirapine to give their babies daily for the 28 weeks. A third group of women and babies were the control. They got the standard of care, that is, AZT during labor and 7 days of nevirapine after birth for the babies. Vanderhorst says the results were dramatic.
We found that, in particular, the baby getting the single daily dose of nevirapine had a dramatic decrease in the number of babies who were infected, and that decreased from in the standard of care arm from 6.4% of the babies becoming infected down to 1.8% being infected. And it was 3% of the babies whose mothers were getting the medications became infected.
One concern raised in the study is that women receiving antiretroviral drugs have to be monitored using expensive lab tests, and that can be difficult. Vanderhorst says giving infants a daily dose of nevirapine is his preferred option.
It's very, very cheap. It's virtually non-toxic, and you don't need to do any monitoring lab tests. You don't need a laboratory to monitor the babies who are receiving it, whereas a mother who's getting three drugs to treat her does need to be monitored to look for anemia and other medication side effects.
One problem with this treatment strategy, says Vanderhorst, is that babies are susceptible to diarrheal diseases once they're weaned at 28 weeks. He believes babies probably should not be weaned and should continue on the medication beyond the 28 weeks. Vanderhorst is planning to study this mode of treatment next. I'm Rose Hoban.
Rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are a major contributor to climate change, and now a new study has confirmed that atmospheric CO2 is also affecting the ocean chemistry, potentially threatening marine life. Montana State University scientist Robert Dorr has been taking samples of water in the Pacific Ocean for almost two decades.
We're sailing out of Honolulu Harbor. We're in the harbor right now and just about to break away from the dock.
I reached him on board the vessel, the research vessel Kilo Moana, about to leave for a point in the Pacific known as Station Aloha, where he's been studying the ocean water since the late 1980s.
We've been going to the same spot in the Pacific Ocean. And one of the key things that we measure is CO2 levels. And we've been able to document this progressive invasion of atmospheric CO2 into the ocean.
As CO2 gets into the ocean, scientists have expected it to affect water chemistry there.
As carbon dioxide dissolves in water, or seawater in this case, it forms a weak acid, carbonic acid. And therefore, as the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere goes up and that exchanges with the surface seawater, it drives the pH down, makes it more acidic.
The samples Dorr and his colleagues have analyzed confirm what the theory predicts.
The pH of the ocean out here has been decreasing, and it has been decreasing at pretty much the rate that we'd expect from the physics and the chemistry.
The lower pH levels, measuring increased acidification, varied seasonally and also from year to year, and it varied with depth. Dorr's laboratory measurements are not just equations and charts in his paper. He says they have a real-world impact.
It's important to realize that acidification of the oceans is really happening, and it can have negative impacts on a whole variety of marine life, from fisheries to coral reefs. It's potentially catastrophic.
Montana State University environmental scientist John Dorr's paper appears this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. As we heard earlier, obesity is costing Americans a lot of money. Healthy eating isn't always easy, and sometimes we may not know the best choices to make. Our website of the week features nutrition advice from a respected source.
The Nutrition Source is a website that helps people cut through nutrition confusion. We provide clear and actionable advice for healthy eating that people can use for their daily meals, and at the same time, we try to dispel some nutrition myths along the way.
Lillian Chung is editorial director of thenutritionsource.org, a project of the Harvard University School of Public Health. The site features nutrition news, advice on reaching and maintaining a healthy weight, and recommendations for eating right.
Focus on whole grains. Pay attention to your protein packages. Choose healthy fats. Avoid trans fats. Eat lots of vegetables and eat whole fruits. So as you can see, there is a section that gives anyone from any part of the world information that they can use and adapt.
The Nutrition Source also features a recipe library, healthy dishes for your family, even institutional-sized recipes if you happen to be cooking for 100 guests. Eating advice you can trust from thenutritionsource.org. That's thenutritionsource.org. Or get the link to this and more than 250 other websites of the week from our site, voanews.com/ourworld.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
You're listening to Our World, the low-fat weekly science and technology magazine from VOA News. I'm Art Chimes in Washington. Earthquakes are one of nature's most destructive forces. You know that if you saw the devastation in Italy in April or in China's Sichuan province last year. Scientists are trying to improve their understanding of earthquakes and the forces that power them beneath the Earth's surface. As we hear from reporter Erica Celeste, a National Science Foundation program called EarthScope is trying to enhance our understanding of earthquake science and bring the excitement of research into classrooms and museums.
The Earth is always in motion, and those groans, moans, and cracks are the movements of the Earth. Just as our planet spins in a never-ending journey around the sun, its mantle plates deep underground are constantly moving and shifting. But much of it happens so slowly, just 5 to 7 centimeters a year, that the sound has to be sped up and amplified so that it can easily be heard by the human ear. Sometimes, though, the Earth moves a lot faster.
We still don't know why there are earthquakes.
Seismologist Stephen Gao has worked in Africa, China, and Siberia. He's currently heading a research team for EarthScope, a project which is seismographically mapping the continental U.S. and Alaska.
Yeah, this is part of a huge project. The idea is to use 400 seismographs to cover the whole U.S. in about 14 years period. So they start from the western coast and move all the way to the eastern coast.
The project is currently entering the area of the New Madrid Fault Zone in Missouri and several nearby states. It's the site of one of the most powerful earthquakes ever recorded in North America.
The key is not to prevent, but to predict. You know, you can tell people when and where an earthquake will occur. Then in that case, you can reduce the damage caused by earthquakes. Right? People can come out from the house, and you can shut down the power, the natural gas line. You can reduce the damage a lot.
The placement of those 400 seismometers is critical. Because the instruments are highly sensitive, they can't be too close to roadways or large trees. Both give off vibrations that could create false readings. So here in Missouri, open cow pastures and hayfields are the best locations. Gail has enlisted the help of 4 students to help identify possible seismometer sites. Today, senior geology major Alicia Metzger from Missouri State University and graduate student Ben Williams of Missouri University of Science and Technology, where Gao teaches, are double-checking one of their candidate sites to make sure it's still suitable. On the way, they explain how the project-sensitive instruments work.
They measure any sort of vibrations underneath, and then they also perform sort of what they describe as like a CAT scan, so that way we get an idea of what the mantle and the bedrock looks like.
She mentioned the CAT scan, and that's why they have the grid of these seismometers. It's because rather than like seeing kind of what's going on under the ground at a specific point, they can kind of pool the resources from all of these seismometers, and that is actually what's able to give them kind of more of a visual picture of what's going on.
A short drive later, the students arrive at Kirby Farms, a scenic cattle ranch off the beaten path, with rolling hills and bright green meadows. Workers will soon build a small underground station at Kirby Farms by digging a deep hole and reinforcing it with concrete. Then a network of sensitive equipment, wires, and meters will be installed to monitor the Earth's activities. Through the use of cellular telephone and satellite signals, the station will transmit data for the next 2 years.
So the information that we're going to obtain by doing this will further advance many fields of science.
Gao says one of the important things about this study is that scientists don't have to wait until it's finished to begin analyzing the data. EarthScope makes it available to everyone via the internet through live streaming.
People already start to publish things. So actually the papers are already being published, that you don't have to wait for till the very end.
As researchers learn more, the information will be used to help educate the public about earthquake science and safety. And scientists and engineers hope to use what they learned from EarthScope to design stronger earthquake-resistant structures and improve earthquake and volcano predictions. For Our World, I'm Erica Celeste in Rolla, Missouri.
And finally today, NASA's Human Spaceflight Plans Committee has been holding a series of public meetings to review the direction of the American space program in the post-shuttle era. The committee will meet in Washington on Wednesday, chaired by former aerospace industry executive Norman Augustine. One of the people they'll be hearing from is Robert Zubrin, head of the Mars Society, which promotes sending astronauts to explore and live on the red planet. I asked Zubrin what he plans to tell the NASA panel.
Well, the Augustine Committee has been set up to reexamine the situation and the proper future goals of the American human spaceflight program. Should we go back to the moon? Should we make Mars our goal? Should we retreat from all this sort of thing? You know, my testimony to the committee is going to be very straightforward and forceful. It's going to be that the American human spaceflight program absolutely needs a driving goal, and that goal needs to be humans to Mars.
You know, we've gotten some wonderful returns on our investment in the Mars rovers, other robotic missions. So what does human spaceflight to Mars deliver that these machines can't?
Oh, well, in the way of exploration, humans vastly superior to a robot. I mean, we've actually, in our practice Mars base up on Devon Island in the Arctic, we've compared the effectiveness of humans to robots, and literally humans are 1,000 times, and I mean that, anything a robot can do, a human can do in 1/1,000th the speed. And there's innumerable things that humans can do that robots just can't do at all. And then if you talk about looking for live organisms, setting up drilling rigs and drilling down to the groundwater and taking it up and taking it into the lab and culturing it and looking at it with microscopes, and these things are all far beyond the ability of robotic rovers. If we want to know the truth about whether there is or ever was life on Mars, we're going to have to send people.
Do we have the technology to send people to Mars, or is this something that needs to be developed?
Well, we don't have the various hardware elements that are needed, but in terms of the general level of technology, we absolutely do. We're much better prepared today to send humans to Mars than they were to be able to send men to the moon in 1961, and they were there 8 years later. If President Obama was to get up this summer and commit the nation to sending humans to Mars, we could be there by the end of his second term.
Do you have a sense of whether the Obama administration, given particularly the economic situation now, presents a political climate that might be friendly to a Mars mission?
There's always other things going on. There was plenty of other things going on when Kennedy committed us to go to the moon in 1961. There's a lot of justification for embracing the goal of humans to Mars, in particular in the current situation. A humans to Mars program would be a tremendous driver for our economy, as Apollo was to the U.S. economy in the 1960s. You know, we were in recession in 61, 62, and the Apollo program drove us right out of it into 5-6% rates of economic growth for most of the decade. It will also be a massive boost for education. science education. The Apollo program doubled the number of science graduates in this country in the 1960s at every level, high school, college, PhD. So we get millions of scientists, engineers, inventors, doctors, medical researchers, technological entrepreneurs. These are the people that advance our economy. These are the people that solve all the kinds of problems that we face. Look, the American space program, the human space flight program in particular, has been on idle since 1973. We haven't gone anywhere new in 36 years. And, you know, here we are, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. We should be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the first Mars landing. But we're not. So we've got to get this thing moving again, and the proper goal for this day and age is Mars.
Robert Zubrin heads the Mars Society. The group is holding its annual convention this weekend just outside Washington. And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, maybe you've got a science question we can answer for you on the show. Our email address is ourworld@voanews.com, or use our postal address, Our World, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Our World is edited by Rob Sivak. Bob Doty is the technical director. And this is Art Chimes inviting you to join us online at voanews.com/ourworld or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science and technology in our world.